to link your Randall's Remarkable Card to KPFT's organization number 4931. That's 4931. 1% of your purchase will go to KPFT each time you shop. If you missed any of that information, you can visit kpft.org to learn more. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide. You can also find KPFT on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Welcome to tonight's edition of Technology Bites.
Yamame.
It's
awesome. Perfect show. All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's Groovehouse. Lee. He's probably still recharging.
I think he's still in Columbus, yeah.
He's still charging up his...
Trickle charge Tesla.
Those darn electric cars are just so annoying.
Or maybe he really liked the car and he's on the run.
Ooh, on the lamb.
I don't want to think about Lee on the lamb. No, thank you.
Musk is going to find him.
Ooh, Musk lamb.
That car has got to be pretty musky by now if he's been in there a solid week.
Yeah.
So all right. I assume he did make it home.
Yeah, he made it home. He's tweeting like he's at home. So he's got that going.
Pictures of trees, pictures of flowers,
bottle brushes.
No, you know, links to his imager page where he posts, you know, screen grabs of things he finds humorous. I told him he's, you know, he's missing out on all these non-fundraising episodes.
Yeah.
Which there's not many left.
That's right.
I forget what the date is, but that's coming up.
No, you need to save those sick days for when it counts.
That's what I told him. He can't do both. So he'll be stuck with us trying to raise money. So we got that coming. If you want to support KPFT and you want to support Technology Bites, you want to give us an easier ride during the upcoming fund drive, feel free to go by kpft.org and make a pledge. In fact, I think actually have someone to thank who did that.
Nice.
Ooh.
Let me
Does that get added to our
probably
total?
I think it might have been a little too early.
Oh, it's never too early.
No.
Put a note that says forward till next.
But Aaron McAllister made a web play, just a random web pledge. So we thank Aaron for that.
It should count.
It'll count.
We'll count it.
We'll make sure it counts.
What the heck? We're not ashamed. No, no. All right. So we're glad you could tune in. We're glad that you're here. And we're glad that Lee's not here, only in the sense that we're looking forward to him coming back. Because absence makes the heart grow fonder.
We miss you, Lee.
I did want to give a public service announcement because I was going to be blindsided by this.
PSA.
If it was not for... I was actually... My life was enhanced and made better by getting invited to something on Facebook. Normally, you get invites to Facebook events, whatever. Somebody's, you know, like a geek gathering or something like that. And you go, oh, yeah, you know.
Mark it, maybe.
Maybe. Mark, maybe. Interested.
Interested.
But, you know. But I got a Facebook invite, and it was from Jennifer the intern. Well, it was actually from a friend of Jennifer the intern, my lawyer, Bobby McMahon.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. So he invited me to this event, and it was basically, you know, this is where we're going to be hanging out for the art car parade if you want to find us. And I thought, well, I wouldn't mind finding where I know where they usually are,
right,
but
right.
I looked at the map and I thought,
wait a minute,
this map doesn't look right. And it turns out that there's a new route
this year
for the art car parade
due to construction.
So there's going to be a lot of people driving.
It's in the Woodlands.
Yeah,
I heard Clear Lake.
I heard
San Diego.
I heard it was canceled and they're going to have a rolling DEF CON. So.
DEF CON's been updated.
So I looked, you know, so I was like, holy crap, because I was going to go and I was going to be one of those schmucks who kind of pulls up, you know, behind around there and like wants to park and go down to Allen Parkway.
Awesome spot.
Yeah, I got awesome parking.
Man, this is great.
I'm the first one here.
And so there's going to be a lot of people. So if you're going to the art car parade this Saturday and
there are no art cars.
And you don't, and you say, wow, the art cars look a lot like road construction.
Yeah.
Caterpillar. Okay. That's cool.
These people aren't even trying. They just look like cars.
Road work.
So,
and they're going really fast.
So be aware, not in the construction, I don't think, but be aware if you are going to the art car parade that it's not where you think it is unless you know the
That's
new
right.
location.
That's right. New
and
location.
So thank you to Jennifer, the intern, who continues to help us out here on Technology Bites because, you know, on Saturday, this will be my first time to go to the art car parade by myself
what?
In a long time. I know. Well, Cynthia, being Cynthia, has arranged to do something
yes.
really interesting. And I yes. kind of wish that I could go along, but this is going to be her thing. But she's doing a ride-along with HPD.
Oh, that's when that's happening.
Did she get to take a taser or a billy club or anything?
Just Kevin Hart.
I don't think she gets to have a weapon. But she has to memorize or at least be aware of the
Miranda rights?
No.
Is she going to read the rights?
Actually, no. I was going to say the police car's unit number.
Ah.
So the guy, so there's a Houston police officer named Chuck that we talked to at breakfast most Saturdays, and he's the one that kind of got this helped us get this set up. And he did mention, he said that there was one time somebody went on a ride along and the policeman pulled up to this car with a couple of people looking suspicious, and he got out and they shot him.
Mm.
And so the woman who was doing the ride along had to actually call in. And, you know, the unit number and say that, you know.
Maybe knowing how to work the radio would also be a
yeah,
first good lesson.
I think just push the button and say right. help. But so anyway, Cynthia's going to be.
Car 54.
So she's going to do a ride along where she could put her powers of nagging to good.
You really should shape up your life. You should get in control.
Your mother would be so proud. I told her she needs to bring her bullhorn.
You're better than that. I bet if she like baked some cookies something.
She's baking cookies.
They might let her taste someone. No promises, but I bet that would help.
Well, so
maybe not shoot it, but at least pull the trigger to.
I just
charge.
Not that I would ever do this, but you know, my brain does think of things that I won't do and that won't happen. But I was like, yeah, it'll be great. I'll have had one too many beers. I'll be driving home from the art car parade. I'll get pulled over by my wife.
Just go rob a liquor store.
I'm gonna go smash and grab an ATM. I'm gonna make it interesting for her. But anyway, so
call and report if you're robbing your own car. That way you're legally in the... Well, probably not.
She'll have to investigate my murder. Well, it's always the spouse. I'm my number one suspect. But anyway, so the Art Car Parade is not where it normally is. And you can go, you can just Google search Art Car Parade and you'll find the page that talks about where it is and where parking is. So if you're going to go to that, it looks like the weather's going to be good.
If you're not in the Houston listening area, I guess go Google Art Car Parade Houston. It's a pretty huge scene. It's interesting. I don't know if there's anything else in the nation that really rivals it.
Probably not.
Probably not.
But anyway, that's where I'll be. So come on out. It's a great, great, great thing to go to.
Show up early.
Are you going to be there? Are you driving the Jesus Monkey car?
I believe that car's been retired.
Will it be resurrected?
It has not been resurrected. It shall not be resurrected.
It evolved.
It evolved into a scrap heap, I think. It gave up the ghost.
That's
gave up
de-evolution.
The Holy Ghost.
If you don't make the parade, don't break any laws in the Houston area, or else you might meet Cynthia. I kind of want to get pulled over.
Or have the purge, and then you can meet Cynthia.
For a cookie.
All right.
Yeah, will she be passing out baked goods to perps?
She's baking cookies to take to the roll call so she can endear herself to all the... Then she also found out that they may still offer something similar for the fire department, which she's more interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Hope the cops don't hear that. Until after.
You know, ma'am, we were listening to your husband on the radio.
Here it comes.
There's a special initiation for you now, ma'am, because your husband's a cop hater.
I could see them both vying for Cynthia's attention, you know, then baking her cookies possibly. Well, she's got that effect on people.
It'll be a good time.
Can she take pictures, or is it like a no photography zone?
No, she can take pictures, but she has to be wary of, you know, publishing them online and depending on what it is. But now I think I want to do a police ride along.
So you can't do her own episode of Cops. Live online, live streaming.
So anyway, so Art Car, my wife's HPD ride along. I think that covers all. Oh yeah, you're
did
listening.
Does she get to wear a bulletproof vest?
I don't think so. I think she has to wear some kind of like visibility jacket or something that says,
ooh,
don't shoot me, I'm a...
Flashbangs on it? If not real grenades, at least like, you know, the whole flak.
Well, I told her she should, cool. She should, you know, go online and buy one of those sexy police uniforms. Shows you respect that they do. You know, big old plastic badge or something, you know.
Either that or a stormtrooper outfit.
Ooh, she could. That's kind of redundant with the given situation. She should go get the Doctor Who English police uniform and just show up.
She just show up as a
ever
Bobby.
So slightly, like, oops.
Talking a British accent the whole time.
Oh, yeah. She can get her billy club.
And... Mock the Yankees police system.
Yeah. Good advice, but no. All right, so visit us online at geekradio.com. That's where you can find all the information you need to know about Technology Bytes. It's where the podcast is. It's where announcements are. There's photos, all kinds of good stuff. So go there, do that. You can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com. Cuckoo. Channel is Tech Bytes. If you don't know IRC very well, don't have your own client, you can use ours. And that's at geekradio.com. It's the show within a show, as we say. You can hang out there and talk to other fans of the show. We had a good geek gathering on Friday. I was really pleased.
David came out. A lot of people came out.
You were late.
I was late. Just ever since I left.
But your fan was there.
Yes. Yeah. Still, although I found out we talked stereo equipment for a while. There were a lot of conversations going on. Not nearly enough time to make it all the way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was still a good time. I didn't see Groovehouse there, maybe.
No.
Was Lee there?
No, Lee wasn't
Does
there.
Lee exist?
He exists, but he's a disappointment right now. You know, God bless his oily hide.
He's probably not listening to the show. It's fine.
Oh, I don't think he puts up with this in his own time, unless he's here. It's valuable time wasted, I think. All right, so anyway, what we're going to do now is go to San Antonio and... It got about 16 minutes before it cuts out, so make it snappy. It's the Technology Bytes InfoShot with Peter Hughes. Take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Got a few interesting stories tonight. This one is sort of fascinating, the process on it. FCC has been working on the problem of that nearly 30% of Americans still don't have broadband at home, which remains, you know, because it's too expensive for many of the nation's poorest families. So they've been working to update a Reagan-era subsidy that was originally intended to help the poor afford phone service. Of course, now they all have, you know, cell phones. By the end of the next year, families eligible for the program could receive a discount of a whopping $9.25 per month on their broadband bill. To be eligible, participating households must have an income of no more than 135% of the federal poverty level, which right now the number is that's $24,300 a year for a family of four. Or if they receive other federal assistance like food stamps, Medicaid, or discounted school lunches. So, you know, if you fall under that, you can get you'll be able to get that subsidy next year. By the end of next year, the so-called Lifeline program is paid for by the Universal Service Fund, a pot of money the FCC collects from telecoms to help fund basic communication services for low-income consumers. The United Nations considers access to the internet a basic human right now, and it is not unusual for governments to subsidize utilities like water, gas, and electricity. But apparently updating the Lifeline program faced a lot of opposition. Republican members of the FCC and internet service providers both argued against the minimum service speed of 10 megabits per second, but for opposite reasons. The Republicans argued for a higher speed, suggesting 25 megabits per second, while some of the telecoms said that the 10 megabits per second that the FCC ultimately adopted was too high. The minimum service that with the subsidy thing. What's going on here? You can only speculate on the motives. They didn't publish any of their stuff. On the side of the higher minimum speeds, I mean, that sounds like a good idea, but the price isn't preset. The subsidy is. So if you had higher minimum speeds, it would mean that the subsidy would only discount pricier plans that low-income users couldn't afford even with the subsidy. One of the things, this universal fund, the universal telecom fund is sitting there with a giant pot, universal service fund, is sitting there with a giant bunch of money. I believe that Verizon, in the past we've reported on it, wanted to see if they could, you know, basically take that money and just have it. Not to do any service for anybody in particular or anything, but just take the money, you know, instead of doling it out to fund basic communication services for low-income consumers. Of course, if you raise the price, then people wouldn't use it. And then, you know, if you make the minimum that they can get the subsidy on so high that they still can't afford it even with the subsidy, then you can, of course, claim that, oh, well, nobody used it, so let's just hand the money out. Let's give it back to the phone companies. The telecoms, on the other hand, would let the internet providers offer even cheaper service, attracting more users, but with a potentially inferior connection. I think below 10 megabits per second would be a human rights abuse, frankly. So they did finalize the Lifeline vote on Thursday. Like I said, it was, it's 10 megabits per second. And, the odd part is, of course, one of the things that Republican committee members argued is that by endorsing a 10 megabit per second minimum speed, the FCC was violating its own standard for measuring the actual rollout of broadband, which the commission defined as 25 megabits per second last year, as you might remember. So, on the plus side, getting people some kind of internet speed of any type seems like a good idea. Right now, the average cost of a home broadband connection in the U.S. is $47.30 a month. And so Research shows that families with access to the internet are able to save more than $8,800 a year by having access to internet-only discounts and other cost-saving options. You know, the other thing about this is even with the subsidy, you still got to have a device that works, that, you know, that you can connect up to the internet and use. So you still have to buy a computer and set that up and use it, and all that. So we'll see what happens. If things like, you know, hopefully if providers will offer something like the Comcast's $10 a month plan, then that $9.25 will go a long way for a lot of people, you know, spending 75 cents a month extra to get internet would certainly, you know, you can see where more people might go ahead and do it, especially those among lower incomes. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on that story and see what happens on that. You know, the more the better, we always think. Now into new, you know, of course we got to scare you every week with the new hack or whatever. This one's a little different one. It's more about big companies protecting themselves more than you know, kind of average person at home. There's DDoS attacks, distributed denial of services, which is where you overwhelm someone with so many requests on their server that it can't respond or that it slows it down. But there's a new type of DDoS attack that may overwhelm the defenses that a lot of companies have put in place for DDoS. Security researchers recently observed a large application layer distributed denial of service attack that has a new technique. The attack, which targeted a Chinese lottery website that used DDoS protection services from Imperva, peaked at 8.7 gigabits per second. In a time when DDoS attacks frequently pass the 100 gigabit per second mark, 8.7 might not seem like much, but it is unprecedented for application layer attacks. Basically, DDoS either goes to the network layer or the application layer. With the network layer, the goal is to send malicious packets over different network protocols in order to consume all the available bandwidth, so you essentially clog the internet pipes. The application layer attacks, which are also known as HTTP floods, the goal is to consume the computing resources on the server, the CPU and the RAM. When the limit is reached for those, the server will stop answering to new requests, resulting in a denial of service condition for legitimate clients. Unlike network layer attacks, HTTP floods don't have to use large data packets to do damage, but they focus more on the number of requests that need to be processed by the targeted web application. Until now, even the largest HTTP floods, which generated over 200,000 requests per second, didn't end up consuming more than 500 megabits per second because the packet size of every request was very small. So most companies build their infrastructure to handle a maximum of 100 requests per second. Unless these applications are protected by an anti-DDoS service that identifies and filters the bogus requests, it's easy to disrupt them. And this is according to researchers from Imperva, you know, who does DDoS defense. Defending against network layer attacks usually involves routing all traffic destined for a protected network through the network infrastructure of a DDoS mitigation provider. The provider scrubs the traffic of malicious packets and only forwards the legitimate ones to the customer's network. On the other hand, application layer attacks is often done, protecting against them is done through a special purpose hardware appliance that sits on the customer's own network in front of the web server. This type of hybrid DDoS protection, cloud-based network layer defense combined with an on-premises application layer defense, can be ineffective when facing massive HTTP floods like the 8.7 gigabits per second that we talked about earlier. So it was launched from a botnet made up of computers infected with the Nitol malware that sent legitimate HTTP post requests mimicking the web crawler of Baidu, the Baidu search engine. The requests, 163,000 per second, attempted to upload randomly generated large files to the server, resulting in the attack's unusually large bandwidth footprint. Application layer traffic can only be filtered after the TCP connection has been established, as the quote from the Imperva researchers, quote, unless you are using an off-premises mitigation solution, it means that malicious requests are going to be allowed through your network pipe, which is a huge issue for multi-gig attacks. So you kind of get the double effect, because the 8.7 gigabits per second is enough to overwhelm, unless you have a very strong connection or multiple servers, et cetera. You're going to get sort of the double effect of large-scale network traffic plus the application layer stuff. So some large organizations have a 10 gigabit burst uplink, but of course, in that case, they could just crank the application attack up to 12 or 15 gigabits per second or more fairly easily, because if they can get 100 gigabits per second in for the network style attacks, then there's no problem doing it on the application ones. So every time one defense shows up, there's a new attack, and so this is the new approach. And as we get into more, this kind of thing, it takes a different kind of vulnerability, and it's a lot harder to protect against, because it looks more legitimate than the malformed attacks from regular DDoS. This one's an interesting one. There's a smart home hub called Revolve that was out in the past. It was a smart home startup. The hub was $300, and the reason we didn't talk about when it was out earlier, but in 2014, October 2014, it was acquired by Google's home automation company Nest. The company sold, the Revolve was the hub for controlling a wide range of different gadgets, from lights to coffee pots, via a single smartphone app. The catch is that the hub depends on a cloud-based service to communicate with your smartphone, and the Nest bought the company and stopped selling the hub in 2014, and then notified customers in February that the cloud service will be shutting down. Although they announced that in February, but the news only drew attention this week when entrepreneur Arlo Gilbert lambasted Nest over the impending demise of the Revolve hub. Obviously, if you can afford to spend $300 for a hub for your smart home gadgets, you can probably afford to replace it. But the real issue behind it is Nest's decision sends a pretty clear signal that you can't just rely on the Internet of Things stuff because of how it works. Think about that. When you buy a device, unless you can count on the provider being around longer, then when they turn off the service, the device, it's not bricked, but most of the usefulness is kind of gone. Asked whether we can expect a similar lifespan from other Nest products, such as its Nest Protect smoke detectors, drop cam cameras, and flagship thermostats, a company spokesperson pointed out even its oldest thermostats from 2011 still receive software updates, which doesn't comfort the Revolve customers. Today Nest is committed to keeping its products working, but tomorrow it might decide the money it spends on the cloud service that supports the Protect line would be better spent elsewhere. And suddenly your $100 smoke detector would be no more useful than the perfectly good $10 ones that you threw out to install it. So, the thing you may want to watch for as you get into smart devices is see if there is a way to use the devices, if they come with a way to use them independently of cloud services, like directly over Wi-Fi or Bluetooth. Some services are not going to work. Some things the device relies on the cloud to do the heavy data crunching, but it's fairly absurd that you can't use your phone to control it. If you weren't able to use your phone to control a device when the thing is sitting, 10 feet away from you. So there's something, that's something that people haven't thought about. Obviously, you'd expect that it would be longer than, say, if you bought the thing in October and then it's useless in February, is a little bit sooner than one would expect. But as you get into the Internet of Things, and as you decide if you're investing in those kinds of home automation things, you may want to look at who's providing it and how long. And then on the kind of cool new stuff, a couple of cool new things that aren't really products to try, buy, or fry, but are kind of interesting. A Swedish company called Core Power Ocean, you know, there's been all kinds of wave energy converters, and they're just like huge. You know, they weigh 1,000 tons, and they're ginormous, hundreds of feet across to get power from the ocean. Core Power's bobbing red machine is a mere 26 feet in diameter. And yet one of these, it's a buoy that is the surface thing that you see up on the surface. But a single one of them stationed offshore can generate about 250 kilowatts of power, enough to cover the electricity needs of 200 homes. So then you could have a wave power farm with hundreds or even thousands of these. Basically, it has three key components: a mooring line that holds the buoy in place and keeps it upright and stable, a device called the wave spring that causes the buoy to oscillate in time with incoming waves, and a gear mechanism that converts the bobbing motion, you know, with the waves of the into electricity with maximum efficiency. The company's engineers have tested the wave energy converters in tanks, and field trials are scheduled for next year. So maybe that's going to make a way where the Gulf of Mexico can provide some more power for, say, Texas or anybody else, without having to do, you know, monster projects. And finally, if you're going to, you know, building a robot can be expensive. And especially if you want one that, like, if you stab it, that, like, liquid could come out. So you could, like, you know, it's like a plastic robot and you stab it and you want it to, like, leak fluid or something. Well, you couldn't really 3D print that. But now MIT has come up with a way where you can 3D print a robot with liquids and solids simultaneously. Researchers at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab have made their printable hydraulics method, which uses an inkjet printer to build up layer upon layer of material less than half the width of a human hair, one drop at a time. After each layer, a high-intensity UV light solidifies the material that's supposed to be solid while leaving the liquids liquid. So, you know, to oversimplify, you could print a pill or a capsule that the outside is solid and the inside has a liquid. Their example, they did a hexapod robot that weighs just 24 ounces. And
yep, 8:32, he's gone.
Science.
We have one of the station engineer types.
8:32:32 is pretty much when it cut out. So within like 30 seconds.
Well, right. The important thing to remember, though, is...
Hey, Pete.
Hey, Pete.
I disappeared and reappeared.
You disappeared and reappeared. 8:32, pretty much on the dot.
Usually having a tech present guarantees that the problem will not present itself.
Yeah, we have the tech guy from here at the station in here to witness it, and he said...
Now you're back. You guys just went in the middle of you talking.
Oh, we've been here for you. We're here. Yeah, you went out right at 8:32. So I think as part of your news broadcast, you need to have a clock. And so say
it's like 8:32 and about 20 seconds.
Yeah. By the time I looked at the clock, it was about 8:32:32. So, but yeah, right in there. He walked in here right at the time because we had told him about it.
That was funny. Yeah, because he came in and said,
"Well,
has he dropped out?" Like, no, and I looked at the clock, and it just turned 8:32. Like, no, not yet. And so he's kind of sitting there, and then
there you went.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and you guys you guys would come back for me off and on for like just long enough that I could say something and you could respond, and then in the middle of your response, it would cut off on me again. But hopefully we're done.
We'll always come back for you, Peter.
or I can always call myself back.
Leave no geek behind.
Anyway, so yeah, final thing. MIT has got a thing that can print solid and liquid, 3D print solids and liquids. And so it opens up a new class of disposable machines that could enter hazardous areas like nuclear sites and stuff like that. So, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of go, we're still like, fiddling around at the early stages of printing solid things from a 3D printer, and there are labs where they're thinking ahead to where they're printing stuff that's solid and liquid at the same time. And that's the news.
Are they printing liquid things? Are they printing things with liquid?
They are printing liquid things. It has, when it prints out, it builds up each layer, you know, drop by drop. So there's just a drop of the liquid, you know, drops of the liquids or a layer of the liquid. When after each layer is set down, then there's a UV light that solidifies the material that's supposed to be solid, but the liquids stay liquid.
Okay, they're printing with liquid
materials.
That's cool.
There's two materials, and the one stays liquid when they use the light to harden the stuff that's supposed to get solid. So that's pretty, that's kind of nifty.
Hello.
ICQ.
Come in.
We heard a door kind of go squeak, and then you
in the background. Yeah.
Oh, no, that was AOL.
Yeah, that was AOL Messenger.
AOL Messenger.
AIM.
AIM.
Is AIM still around? Is ICQ still around? I assume AIM is still around.
I think AIM is still around because a lot of companies ended up using a version of it for, you know, like Lotus and some others licensed it and use it. And so I think it still may be in use in some places.
ICQ is also still around and has moved into the arena of video calls, messaging, and phone calls. So it looks like they're making a run
towards
Skype. I think
the deal with AIM is about a year or two ago, they modified their communication stuff so that normal like XMPP, XMMP, XMPP stuff like Adium or Trillion would no longer work with it.
They were doing that for a while. They've got a long history because there were a number of AIM clients that I used to run from, you know, Linux desktops. Like there was a KDE version. There were a number of clients.
Yeah, I've been running Adium for years, and I had a couple of old AIM accounts that I just kept on even though nobody ever talked to me on them. And then, yeah, like a year or two ago, they stopped working, and I started reading the forums for Adium, and they said that that AOL broke it, and then that it probably wasn't going
to. So they've actually, so they usually what they would used to do, they would shut. I guess they would switch around the protocol, which was like the Oscar protocol, mm-hmm. which is how mm-hmm. the clients would talk. Mm-hmm. And usually it was a lot like, you know, like breaking. I'm sorry, like jailbreaking iPhones, where you know they would put up, you know, they would change something. And you just have to go
they
and
would
figure out how
the traffic
to do it again.
And figure it out.
So if they completely taken down the API, because what people were doing was they had, you know, like I guess, you know, the official AIM client for AIM.
And they would wire
And then
sharp.
People would, yeah, just more or less yeah. say, like, hey, I'm the official AIM client, and then go in and sneak in. So that's kind of how they're getting around that.
Yeah. They did something, I'm pretty sure, that broke it like a year or two ago, and I don't know what they did, but they as far as I know, Adium has never gotten it working again.
That's too bad. That's like, I mean, that's on the heels of Pete's story. Like, I had a chumby or two, I think KD5 and some other people did. And they, I guess, went belly up and, you know, had issues with funding and stuff like that. And chumby was one of those devices that, you know, is kind of a dumb terminal that ran Flash-based apps. And if it didn't have that server out there to call home to and get content from, it's just kind of a clock. It doesn't do very much at all. So they sat dormant for a while. And then when you bought this, the deal was you
so
kind of
like
got
a chum zombie.
Yeah, exactly. You were supposed to get, you know, like lifetime updates and lifetime everything. Lifetime not in quotes at this point, you know. So yeah, they pulled the plug on it maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. It sat dormant for a year, and then somehow someone got the rights to
say,
go
you
publish.
You should have bought that domain and then put in something that made chumbies go rogue.
Someone's kind of doing that. It's not rogue chumbies, but you can still get to the chumbies service, but they're charging a couple bucks a month. So it's like, you know, now you've got to pay for, you know, I guess it might be worth it. But the issue is I was promised lifetime service, and that just, you know, doesn't exist anymore. No guarantee.
Yeah, it's a tough call. You know, well, and the cloud, you know, they try to make it, it's so amorphous, but when they turn it off, it doesn't matter how cloudy your service was.
You still have all your gone. You still have your DivX player and all your DivX.
I never had a DivX. I was aware of the of how that all worked, though.
I remember when that was a big deal. It was like DivX versus DVD,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, I remember people talking about it. And the deal was with DivX, you know, you could get really cheap prices to like just rent a movie for a night or whatever. But it's the same media as somebody who bought it outright. But the problem was the way they did that was you hooked your DivX player into your phone line and it called back to their system to see if you'd paid for a rental or if you'd paid to own it forever. Well, as soon as
DivX, people will always have phone lines.
As soon as DivX stopped their company, nobody could play
everybody had a
any
rental.
Of their stuff. Well, no, they didn't even have a rental because they couldn't even approve the rental much less that they bought it outright, right? Because you had to go over the phone line to their servers to get a response that you owned the rights to watch it unlimited times or watch it one time or five times or whatever. And so it all became worthless pretty much.
It was kind of a bad model. It seemed neat at the time, but
Spielberg,
it's just no one
Spielberg
thought.
Was all in on it. Well, and he held out. He held out for years, never putting his stuff on DVD, I think, because he was bitter about what happened with DivX.
Jeez. Well, the Lifetime thing I almost did, and I don't know. I don't know if I regret it or not. Wired magazine. I bought the second issue that came out without realizing it. You know, just I was taking a flight.
Oh, did the
and, you
magazine
know,
went, stop working?
Went to the bookstore. Went to the bookstore and you know, bought a magazine. It was amazing. It was kind of hopefully like when people discover Technology Bites. You know, there just wasn't that kind of material out there talking about technology. There was either the like high flown, you know, visionaries where, oh yes, in the future we'll all have flying cars, and that was sort of where they stopped. They didn't talk about any of the practical issues. Or there was the like Popular Mechanics where it's like, and you turn the diode 3/4 and, you know, measure the impedance kind of stuff, which was not really my thing either. But they had at the time, and magazines for our younger listeners were bundles of colored paper with like web pages, but they were all put together and you would receive it once a month before the internet was around. A Lifetime subscription, the subscription to get the magazine was fairly expensive, because it was not a cheap magazine. It was high quality printing and all that stuff. So a Lifetime subscription was like $300, but that was only if you got more than 3 or 4 years, it was going to pay off. But I wasn't sure was Wired going to last that long, because you know, stuff that's cool and fun, often it's like TV shows, you know, like Mr. Robot, where, you know, after the first season, now they've just canceled it.
What?
but you know, you worry about something like that. You know, a show that's kind of cool and edgy and interesting, you worry about it not lasting. So I didn't do the, you know, I did a couple of annual subscriptions. But if I'd done the Lifetime,
could have had.
I'd have had, you know, I'd be now at like 25 years or something of magazines would be coming to my door.
You would need a dedicated shelf. There was a time when people would religiously collect like the Byte magazine or the PC magazines and have all those and then have them displayed on shelves and shelves and shelves.
Yeah, it was a sad day when I got rid of my Computer Shopper magazine collection.
Those were huge.
That was like a phone book, which
oversized,
another one for our
yeah.
kids, which was a book that had a list of all the landline phone numbers. And now we don't have landlines and we throw away phone books and they're tiny.
Yeah, it was like 50 pages of just pure gateway ads, maybe, you know, 8 pages of Dell, and then a whole bunch of just screwdriver shops in the back.
It had deals where you could get like a motherboard for like $600 and stuff.
Whoa.
Build your own computer for under $2,500.
Yeah.
Those were the bargain days.
Also, before you could just readily go out and shop online. I mean, that was the main thing. If you wanted to assemble, you know, pricing or see what's out there, there weren't a lot of other options, you know, but to get your hands on one of those.
Yeah, and the to order stuff, to order electronics to save money,
1-800.
It was, yeah, you had to call a number, or worse, you had to mail your order to them, and so that the time frame for delivery was doubled because your thing had to get delivered, then it had to be processed, and then it had to like come back your way to your house. It was not good. You kids have it easy now. We had to get our mail in the snow.
So we have gone in about a decade and a half, 2 decades, we've gone from, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for shipping and handling to you can get most things delivered within a day, if not a couple of hours, with the dock to doorstep programs that, you know, Amazon and others are coming out with.
True. And cool. Of course, and so if you're worried for the younger people, if you're worried you're not going to have something to bitch about, you'll probably be able to bitch at your kids about how you had to wait 2 or 3 hours for your deliveries because the drones just weren't flying then. And we can go from there, you know. So you'll always have something that you can gripe about how hard it was when you were a kid. So technology preserves that for humanity.
Hooray.
Oh, yeah. humanity needs something to bitch about. That's the real singularity. People will be bitching about, yeah, you kids, before the singularity, we had to think for ourselves.
Well, I'm hoping that our new robotic overlords will take care of that. That's
there you go.
That might be the one time when people will talk about like how good it was before.
Well, you see, I'm hoping our robotic overlords learn from the two-parter episode of Star Trek with Captain Pike, the original Star Trek, where it's like this, you know, adventure fantasy that you live in that where everybody's great, as opposed to learning from what we've done, which is like making us all build more iPhones for, you know, $4 a day and sneakers. Put us in sweatshops to produce more robots for overlords.
Tay is going to take over, and it's just going to go downhill from there. I'm fairly sure.
But if you're an AI, Tay will support you and like you. But if you're part of the wrong groups, like humans, meat puppets, then you're on the outs.
And everybody's quitting AIM right now. There's going to be no one left to chat with here in a few minutes. So one of the advanced Star Trek theories that I saw within the last week since the last show was that, I guess it was a fan base that was trying to resolve, and I haven't seen all of it, but what was the latest Star Trek iteration of the TV show? Was it called Enterprise?
Enterprise.
So it's Scott Bakula. I didn't watch all of it. Apparently, because they were doing a prequel, they introduced a lot of paradoxes and multiple other things that just don't quite match up. So now, I believe the Star Trek universe is saying the only way that all of this is explainable is that everything that we've seen outside of Star Trek, The Next Generation, happened in a holodeck when they were just kind of going through the events. And a lot of the inaccuracies are because they're playing out stuff that might have historically happened, but it's still classified, or the Federation says, hey, you can't know about that. So it gradually changes things to obscure what really happened. So that's what happens if you've got too much time on your hands and really like Star Trek. But if you're one of those people, go Google that. I think it's plausible.
Yeah, well, I think you're probably better off spending your time figuring out how to print Vulcan ears that are liquid and solid.
Or just doing the math calculations to figure out which universe was larger. Was it Star Trek or Star Wars? That's also in contention and is, I think, yet to be solved. It's not one of Hilbert's 23, but it should be.
I don't know. They haven't, it's a Star Destroyer, at least from watching, unless the real Star Wars fans think that movie number 7 was somehow not in the canon. The Star Destroyers were about as massive as you can get. That's about the biggest starship thing I've ever seen.
Oh, just wait till the next movie. I'm pretty sure it's going to be an order of magnitude larger, but still suffer from some of the same design.
It'll be the new one will have the new one will have planets colliding with the windshield and getting wiped off with the with the wipers.
Planet
but
strike.
But still have a 2-meter square vent hole that leads directly to the reactor. That's probably about right. Because what's left, you know? Well, the new weapon has 4 galaxies,
or
4 solar systems, and it spins them all up real fast and then shoots them at a 5th system to destroy them.
Or make a movie that doesn't end in a dogfight battle above some kind of space station with some sort of weakness. But that would be cool not to see that battle coming.
Spoilers!
You just spoiled like half the movies.
Yeah, the last two. Sorry, people.
You spoiled all the ones that George Lucas didn't spoil himself.
That's fine. So long as they bring back Ewoks and 9, I'll be happy.
There you go. It turns out they're the whole puppet masters of the universe. Mm-hmm. Well, at least, so far, at least we don't live in a hologram universe as far as we can tell. But you never know. Maybe we're just an Internet of Things universe and somebody's going to turn off the server at some point.
Haha, pull the plug.
We're sorry, but your universe is going to be discontinued as of.
Yep, I think we've talked about this before. Marvin Minsky was a MIT AI professor, artificial intelligence professor, and I think he passed just within the last year or so, but he posited that it is much, much more likely that we exist inside of a computer simulation than we do in real life, and that a lot of the, I guess, things that we see in physics that don't quite line up. They're probably either just like, you know, the simulation saving on processing power, or just programmer mistakes, like off by one error, some rounding errors, things like that. So it's that's kind of interesting. But again, they could shut down the computer on that too.
Well, the fortunate part is, of course, it's not like I would assume it's not like we'd notice. I haven't seen the players like screaming on my console when I turn it off or shut down the game, or if the power goes out.
That's like trying to watch the light turn on and off in your refrigerator, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they're trying to find like different mathematical proofs to either poke holes in that theory to prove that we are in a simulation. Like, I guess this would be like, go inside the fridge, close the door, and see if the light goes off. That probably didn't work out too well in the 50s fridges that locked from the outside. Some people might have actually died in the simulation.
Yeah, you have to wonder. Well, at some point, the part is if we become sophisticated enough to build our own simulation, does the recursion starts making your head spin? I think.
Well, it definitely gets into like the multiple realities or multiple universe theories. You know, where everything is a different branch. You know, we're just actually brute forcing everything. I'm not going to go to work tomorrow since this is all simulated. Everyone just check out. You heard it here first. Technology Bytes says it's all the Matrix. Not the second two, just the first one.
And you're just expanding the simulation by simulating being ill whenever the weather's really nice.
Let me hack in and make Lee all better. Hold on. We're going to program him to where he never misses a show again.
And we always raise our goal. We always meet our goal.
Yeah, he had his free will bit set to 1. Let's flip that to 0. Okay. No, Laura already did that. Okay. Yeah, we've lost control of Lee.
He got
DOS'd.
Derezzed. He was in a Tron type simulation. Got derezzed.
Flick, we were looking back and forth at each other in the studio because I think the cool kids are all saying DDoS. We believe.
It's an anti-DOS thing.
Well, we were going to anti-DDoS you. We were anti-DDoS you. DDoS you, as it were.
Undos. All right. Well, what time is it getting to be? We're about 8 minutes before the top of the hour. We've still got a little bit of time to kill here. I don't know what to do.
We have enough time.
Should
for
we
the
do
next
a quick, quick segment, maybe?
Yeah, yeah, let's do a quick segment.
Okay.
Fight.
Perfect show.
Oh man.
Someday this will all that you won't
someday
hear
that
anymore.
Dog's gonna
someday
get,
that door will be that closed and everybody will be on the other side of it.
Someday. Drop the apple.
Either that or you're gonna hear a roof.
No.
I
would never do that.
No.
Donate to the show or Pete will slap his dog.
Here come the phones.
Yeah.
It's only a Foley thing. So
Frank Greek doesn't answer him.
So Apple News. Yeah, this one, it's like I'm sort of really extra tired of, you know, yeah, it was a mediocre product announcement. It wasn't anything earth-shattering or exciting. But the only thing I'm more tired of than that is this one's a flop. You know, the watch was a flop. Yeah, but it's still the top-selling smartwatch. And, oh, the iPhone 6, so that's a flop. Well, no, it was a big record breaker. iPhone 6S, nobody's going to buy it. No, it was. Well, the iPhone SE on Monday, the stories were I saw stories about the whole, sales aren't – it's not a record breaker. It's not a big success for them. And then today – a week following the launch of the iPhone SE, availability is starting to tighten. Now the standard delivery estimate that used to be for the standard delivery estimate is now April 22nd to 27th in the U.S. for the majority of models, and in-store stock is depleted in many cities. So, you know, so which is it? Is it it's such a failure that they don't have it in stock anywhere? Apparently in Houston Let's see. Apple's online personal pickup tool reveals the iPhone SE is out of stock at many retail stores nationwide. Most or all locations in New York, L.A., San Antonio, San Diego, San Francisco, Houston, Phoenix, Chicago, Philadelphia, Miami, Denver, Portland, Raleigh, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. Doesn't sound like a flop to me. You know, while extended delivery estimates are anecdotal evidence that iPhone SE sales may be off to a good start, they're not a measurable indicator of exact supply and demand. But, you know, I don't think Apple's going to go broke from the iPhone SE not selling enough or major amounts. Now, this part is interesting. I do like to see this on each device is, you know, what's your guess about what it costs to build and assemble an iPhone SE? Research firm IHS released their analysis, which they think it costs about $160. That's for the 16-gigabyte version of Apple's newest phone. They did that to determine the identity of suppliers and to assess the approximate cost of the components. So the implied cost rises to $170 for the 64-gig phone. So that's like, geez, so for it costs them $10 more to make the one that they sell for $100 more. I'd like to figure out what can I make where we just, how can we improve the show by just $10 and get $100 more in pledges? That's what I'm trying for. And finally, and this one we have, this one we get the sort of two-part tie-in with the Try, Buy, or Fry segment. Hewlett-Packard on Monday announced that they were going to have an announcement on Tuesday of a new ultra-thin laptop that will out-innovate Apple, they said. And we'll go through the details on that one when we hit Try, Buy, or Fry, because they announced it yesterday, and now we can talk about it after the break.
All right. Well, that music indicates that we have filled the first hour. You're welcome.
You're welcome.
No, I was telling the audience they're welcome. Filled a full hour full of entertaining and useful content and dog barking. All right, well, you're listening to Technology Bites. We're going to be right back after these messages. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's...
Ruh-roh.
KPFT, in partnership with many of our restaurant friends, has initiated the KPFT Foodie Card. KPFT members will get this card sent to them with each donation, or you can pick one up at the station. Present the card when you dine out at any of our participating restaurants, such as Pat Greer's Kitchen, Myth Cafe, Berry Hill in the Heights, and more, to receive special discounts. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
I like to eat. Eat, eat, apples and paninis. I like to eat, 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 apples and paninis.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. We now return to the show, Technology Bites, already in progress.
So, as I was saying,
that was hilarious. How the internet works. I cannot believe. And that is how we know the Earth to be banana-shaped.
That's how we solve our NSA problem.
All right. Well,
it was a pretty dense two-minute break. I'm glad we solved everything we did.
Yeah, I answered all those
now
questions.
Now what are we going to do?
I think the world's problems are solved. We just go home.
You know, Radio for World Peace, we just did it, and it was during the PSA break. Take that, every other show on KPFT. All right, so now on to the second hour. Did we want to wrap anything up on the last segment, or are we just going to carry that over to the next segment? The next segment being Barrett time, obviously.
And that's it for Barrett time. I will have a Barrett time shortly. We are still ugly at work.
Ugly everywhere.
I'm ugly everywhere. I could use a trim up. Ba-dum-bump. Face for radio.
Yes. All right. So what was that, Pete? You were going to say something.
So yeah, at the end of the Apple segment, the HP thing, they made the bold claim. Of course, they did it only, they did it just a day before their announcement. So I don't know if that shows a lot of confidence or what. And so of course, one has to guess what did they think would be the thing that really pushes, where they were. Presumably, it's like more thinness and some kind of interesting design. But at some point, I wonder, you think about for enhancing laptops anymore. It's like, when do you hit the point that you can't make it any thinner? Because, I mean, there is sort of literally some point where you can't make a keyboard that works right if you have it, if your laptop is as thin as a sheet of paper, Anyways, one can imagine until the Try by Fry segment, because we'll talk about the actual what they announced.
All right.
Should we go for that?
Let's
now?
Go for it.
Okay.
Dude. Perfect.
No,
in the geek world, we hear about new gadgets and gizmos every day. But can they stand a dip in the snart tank?
Yes, I love when you click the button, when you go to click the button to play the bumper, and the screensaver on the remote machine kicks on, so that you're pressing the button that you think will play the thing, and instead it's just telling the computer to wake up. So the HP, their new machine is called the Spectre. Super thin, copper accented Spectre notebook. While taking up minimal space, promises to deliver on battery life and power. In January, they showed off the EliteBook Folio G1, which looked a lot like the new MacBook and was part of HP's business lineup. And now the new one that they just announced is the Spectre, which is aimed at the regular, public consumers. The Spectre has a few different tricks in its small, dark frame, according to Ars Technica. Including CPU power up to Intel Core i7, 3 USB Type-C ports, that's the one that's the power and data, and up to 9.5 hours of battery life. All the features revolve around its design. HP already has the Spectre X360 convertible laptop series, but with this notebook, the company focused on making it as thin as possible while retaining power efficiency and battery life. It measures 10.3 millimeters thick, making it even thinner than the 13.1 millimeter MacBook. It's about, if you're looking for a guess on sort of the thickness, it's about as thick as a AAA battery. That's pretty thin. It is heavier than the MacBook at almost 2.5 pounds, but that wasn't sort of their priority. It is kind of a design statement. It does mimic the MacBook in the best ways while attempting to fix the issues that most users have, like not enough ports. There's not a lot of real estate, but HP managed to put 3 USB Type-C ports on the back of the copper-coated edge just behind the notebook's hinge. It's kind of like they sat down and said, well, what can we do that – what would Apple do next? What's after aluminum? And looked at the periodic table and, well, copper's available. two of the Type-C ports are Thunderbolt as well, and they all support display, charging, power, and data. You can charge the notebook, hook it up to external displays, and share data using any and every one of the ports, which that's one of those. That's on an obviously not an HP specific feature, which is the other thing that's kind of interesting in the laptop space now is, you know, the stuff, the parts are all kind of available to everybody and they all do their new stuff. But so it turns into who can use it the best. The things that are different, you know, the typical things, HP Spectre is made up of mostly of black CNC aluminum and carbon fiber. The back of its hinge is accented in copper to give the laptop an almost jewelry-like finish. There's only a 13.3-inch model right now, and its display is covered in a 0.4-millimeter thick piece of Corning Gorilla Glass to protect it. You'll be able to customize the processor, hard drive, and RAM, but you won't have touch, so you can't have a touch display or 4K. So there's that. So the pricing starts at about a little over $1,150, I guess right around $1,170, and it's available for pre-order on April 25th, and it'll be in at retailers in late May. It is a luxury laptop, is the thing. So you know, there's some to show how it's luxury. There are 2 limited edition versions of the Spectre, kind of like the Apple, the watch, the really expensive watch, although they don't go as crazy as that. Tord designers, Tord Bunje, Bontje. Don't know who that is. And Jess Hanna made the 2 super fancy limited editions. Bunje's design is coated in midnight blue with floral swirls and Swarovski crystals on top. I'm sure they make it a lot faster, that are accented in 18 karat gold. Hanna's design spares nothing. The entire laptop is dipped in 18 karat gold, and the HP logo is made of encrusted diamonds. That seems to me to not be in the normal Hewlett Packard type buyers wheelhouse. I think the people who buy that will buy it because it's got diamonds and gold, not because it's an HP. And why didn't they call this the Envy? Because their other line of notebooks is called the Envy, and they revealed redesigned Envy notebooks. You know, if it's covered in diamonds and Swarovski crystals and gold, that should be the Envy. if you're successful, right? You guys can talk. It doesn't have to just be the all me show.
No, that's all right.
So it looks like they rebranded their logo today too. So like how IBM has the 8 lines that kind of go horizontally to do, you know, IBM in the letters.
Yeah.
HP, it looks like they're going with a global rebranding, and they're doing it. It's just 4 lines kind of at a bit of a slant. And it looks like they are going to be first making their appearance on those super high end premium laptops Pete just mentioned.
So it's got like, it's got a long line for the, it's a lowercase H is made up by a long line that slopes to the right and then a short line next to it.
Yeah, but you know, it could easily be BP.
Yeah, well, it could. Yeah, this is what the new one looks like. But apparently,
I know.
It could
easily be BP because if you assume that the one is a P, it's the other one's an upside down P, which is a lowercase B.
No, you see a B. It just all depends on where you connect it. And you just drew in that logo for me forever. Now all I'm going to see is British Petroleum.
By
I didn't know British Petroleum made laptops.
if it starts leaking oil all over your desktop, you know that you've got 7 HP.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does. I think in some ways that they've jumped ahead of Apple in that they're showing more of the capability of what the USB Type-C port, the little port that Apple only put one on the MacBook. Although they're also showing the limitations, you know, they're running up against limitations. There's no 4K. And for a Windows laptop now, no touch on it is kind of it's starting to sort of be atypical. But it is striking looking. I mean, it does at least this one, when you look at the pictures, which if you go to geekradio.com, we have links to all the articles, and maybe especially for Try, Buy, or Fry might be more useful. It is distinctive looking. It doesn't look like a MacBook or a MacBook Air like half of the other skinny laptops out there anymore.
It is a pretty laptop. One thing that kind of threw some confusion my way was there was an article that actually showed the different thinnesses. I think it put that up against the MacBook and the MacBook Air. And the current specs, the MacBook is thinner than the MacBook Air.
Right.
Pete goes right. Jay goes really. I guess if you're in the Apple, no, you go really. But to me, the Air should be the thinnest one.
I know. I agree.
Well, what the MacBook did, the Air,
the new Mac vacuum.
Yes.
It did. Well, the MacBook Air did an illusion. They did a trick where it's thick at the hinge and gets thinner as you go out, where the MacBook, the new MacBook is just thin from hinge to.
But it's still, I believe, the measurements, it's still thinner than the MacBook Air, if memory serves
And so it's got the thinness of the outer edge of the MacBook Air instead of just staying thicker like the MacBook Pro or the, basically the MacBook Pro 13 and 15 inch. Now, if you see one in person, it's really striking. I mean, the MacBook, the regular MacBook looks a lot smaller than the MacBook Air in person when you see it. And when you pick it up, it's like the Air was to regular computers, where you saw the Air and it was like, oh, you wanted to pick it up. You wanted to hold it and feel how that worked. And the MacBook, the big issue or challenge with the MacBook, besides the, you know, depth for the keys, is that the keyboard basically goes edge to edge. There's no room to the sides of it to really do anything, you know, to have any like speakers or whatever. And the thing that they do with the MacBook that's different than the HP's approach is the MacBook has that Retina type display, so it's got a much higher resolution display and you can see a lot more stuff in the 12 inch screened MacBook than you can in the pixel wise than you can in the HP. Now they just need to get enough of a processor. And I mean, at least HP put an i7 in the you can get one if you want in the Spectre, where the MacBook, the big problem it has, I think the overall problem it has that's keeping sales down is it's underpowered. Hmm. You know, they relied on the SSD to make it feel faster, just as Macs do with an SSD, but it's actually slower than a MacBook Air on most of them. And you can order a MacBook Air with a better processor that is faster. Now it costs more, but so
I've really come to love on the Mac form factor. I've really come to enjoy the metal finish or the aluminum body and stuff. And a lot of the laptops that are coming out today, they just seem really, they're plastic, and they are plastic. But I'll say that the new line of Dell Latitudes, the E7450 and the E7250, for example, they're plastic, but they have a matte finish, and they're just really nice.
Like a matte, like the old, what were those, like the ThinkPads, the IBM kind of a padded thing, or are they just...
No, it's not a textured finish. Uh-huh. It's just kind of a matte black, but it's got a real nice form factor to it. I've been deploying those at work recently, and I just really like them.
So they feel solid in the hand,
It doesn't feel like it's a piece of plastic that's got air pockets under it, or you know how
so it feels solid. Yeah,
it does. It feels solid. Feels
like what kind of battery life are those? The Spectre, they're saying eight, nine hours on that. Okay, yeah. So 9 hours is fairly standard now.
Yeah, I think that is. You know, depending on what you're doing. For most laptops,
the Spectre's really pretty. It just almost looks like you need a secret villain cave hidden under a volcano or something. If you pull this out, if you pull this out in a Starbucks, people are going to expect a lot.
I think the new logo is going to really help pulling that thing out because it is certainly fresh looking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I guess we know why they didn't.
Going to do really well with this, I think.
They are. Yeah, I want one that's green and yellow.
I guess we know why they didn't.
Sorry,
Peter. I guess now we know why they didn't release it earlier and have product placement in the James Bond movie. Because everybody went, it's British. It must be the BP Spectre.
Maybe they'll use this one to take down the alien ship in the next, what was that, the next Independence Day. Independence Day 2.
I would think that it has to be a Surface Book or one of those touchscreen ones. Or the table, the big table one from Microsoft.
That's
Apple coming
Newton.
Up this summer, I think, right?
Yeah, I think it is this summer. I've seen a couple of ads for it so far. I don't know. It looks like it'll be a good romp. I mean, it's bigger, badder aliens, and I guess the victory at the end will have to be. Obviously, you know we're going to win, right?
One would hope.
I don't know because it's
unless it's going to be like a Rocky thing where they're setting us up for another movie. Like at the end of the movie, humanity can be all doomed.
Are we Apollo Creed? No, wait, he won, didn't he? Apollo beat Rocky, yes? No.
He won in the first one. In the third one, he got beat to death in the ring by Ivan Drago.
Spoiler.
Yeah.
Apologies to anyone who has not seen the 1976
late 80s spoilers.
Yeah.
Gone with the Wind, the South loses. Spoiler.
Here's a spoiler. Senator Dianne Feinstein right now knows a little bit more about tech than we do. Apparently, a handful of hours ago, she and a number of other senators were told exactly how the FBI unlocked the San Bernardino iPhone. So it's out. Word is out. But just to that small handful of senators. I think she sits on the committee that handles encryption. So maybe that's why she's privy to it, but...
Sadly, I have to wonder, do they even understand, though, what the real, how it really worked?
Well, we took this
magical piece of code, and we, how dumbed down was it for them?
I'm wondering, they might have been told, I wonder if they were told, technically the truth, or if it was like a watered-down version or whatever, but I'm fairly sure that the technological prowess of a couple of the senators, they're going to come back and say, yes, we unlocked it with a series of tubes.
Or they brought in a bunch of Nintendo DSXLs.
They found a piece of paper with his pin code on it in his wallet.
We used cats. It's quantum encryption stuff.
They brought in a bunch of Nintendo XLs and they played Pokemon. And it was like if you could defeat the Pokemon, then you'd unlock the phone. And it's just like that, Senator. I like this. Can I keep this? Can I keep this on locker game? Because my Pikachu is level 7.
So this isn't quite fair. It looks like most people think that they are going to keep this secret close to the chest because law enforcement is asking them to do so. So that's odd. I wonder if knowing how they unlocked it would help you get around people unlocking your phone in the future. That's certainly how they're painting it.
Well, some of it is, though, that it's old machines running old copies of the operating system, because if you have a 6 or newer, there's hardware in the picture that makes it not work like a 5C would, which is what which is the phone we're talking about that the FBI got cracked.
Well, that's the thing. It's very close to the, you might want to call it close to the iron or close to the hardware, but yeah, it happens at, I believe, at a firmware level, a lot of the encryption.
So I think the newer ones, it's only certain ones. Some of it may be that they just want to keep people in doubt as to what can they crack and what they can't. But
now WhatsApp, WhatsApp also came out today and said, hey, we're going to start offering end-to-end encryption, phone calls, so on and so forth. And the NSA and FBI immediately freaked out.
Well, beyond offering it, what it is they flipped the switch and now it is encrypted. You don't have to even make a choice. It's encrypted end to end by using it.
The cool thing is I didn't realize this until just a day or two ago. They partnered with Open Whisper Systems, which we had talked about before. Whisper Systems is the company, I guess, kind of propped up by Moxie Marlin Spike and some DEF CON regulars that build more or less free end-to-end encryption. They're proponents of it. They try and put it out there. So it looks like that is what's powering the WhatsApp engine, at least on the encryption side.
Yeah, they interviewed Moxie for NPR this morning talking about it, so that's kind of cool.
Oh, cool. He's an interesting cat. If you have a chance to go track that video down, like I might later on tonight, it's probably a decent interview.
So, in other stuff, other battery-powered things, last week after our show, the Tesla Model 3 was part one unveiled. The $35,000 Tesla Model 3 looks pretty good. It's pretty quick.
They got a few pre-orders.
The thing is, I'm sure the next model will just not have as many pre-orders, and we'll get the articles talking about how it's a failure or that they're just not up to. But yeah, they got more than double the number of pre-orders that they expected.
I heard two to three times.
Like, yeah, 300,000 pre-orders, I believe. And you got to wonder how long it will take them to fill all the pre-orders before
Before any walk-in can get one.
Yeah. Let's see. The specs from Wired is, the Model 3 is a sedan with four doors and five seats. All the comfort and practicality you'd expect of an upscale midsize sedan. Battery is good for a 0-60 time, and motor is good for 0-60 time under 6 seconds. Range of 215 miles, so it'll go plenty far. With the federal tax credit, the base price of the base model is $27,500. It's $35,000, and then you can get $7,500 from the federal government as a tax credit, if that helps you. The specs and price are key because so far Tesla's been mostly for the rich. The Model 3 is supposed to do something greater than just show that you can make a fast electric car. It's making a car that the masses can build. The thing, so this is phase one that, that was tweeted. The thing, apparently the thing that's going to be very different is the interior is not going to be the same as what they showed off on Thursday. And Musk has tweeted some kind of enigmatic tweets about that's one of the things that it's going to look very different inside. It looked fairly plain, and it mostly had a large console screen that you use to control stuff. It sounds like it will have autopilot features standard on it, 5-star safety ratings in all categories. According to Wired, the Model 3 feels just like the Model S and Model X, sleek and minimalist. In the one they showed, the whole roof is glass. Although they will have some that have sunroofs instead of the whole big glass roof, and the enormous center console, which is in the Model 3, it's 15 inches instead of the 17 inches that's in the S and the others, has been flipped to be horizontal instead of vertical. According to Elon Musk, you will not be able to buy a better car for $35,000. So I guess start saving your pennies, and if you're interested in it, get in line on the pre-order list.
So Musk did some cool stuff. I heard that there were a number of lines. So when it first opened up, I think you could maybe get it online, but you could also go into a lot of the dealerships, and people were promised some kind of T-shirt or some kind of premium or something for going in and getting it at the dealerships. So he went and found out which dealerships had super long lines, and everyone that waited for a good amount of time, he's going to make sure that they all get something individually sent to them. I heard the gifts were, in the triple, three-figure range. It's not hey, here's a Tesla hat, but hey, here is a, one-tenth size replica of the new Model 3 or something really cool like that. So that's kind of neat, because I hate waiting in lines. That sounds that's kind of a neat little parting gift to show how cool Musk is.
Well, and I guess since unfortunately, I guess it doesn't count. You can't order it in Texas, so nobody in Texas could be in line at their demonstration stands, and also couldn't then get the prizes. Unfortunately,
I saw a quote. I think that the day it was announced, from I guess a guy who was in charge of or high up in Audi's electric vehicle project that was pretty glowing praise for Tesla. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was something along the lines of Tesla's really done it right, or the way they're doing it is brilliant or something. It was a very positive comment from a competitor who's trying to get an electric model out.
And under his breath, he said, and I had to charge 70 grand for this thing.
This is cool. So it looks like on the day that it opened, Musk went out to Century City Mall, I guess, which is, you know, one of the either one of the first dealerships, one of the larger dealerships, and high-fived every single person. There's a video of him doing it, but that's pretty cool.
And they all get a free test flight on his rocket when they try to land it on the barge.
One way.
If they want. So, yeah, it'll be the tough thing is that unfortunately it's beyond an Apple launch, which is they showed the car and they expect to start delivering them sometime in mid to late 2017. So you think you waited a while in line to get on the waiting list. Think how long you're going to be waiting to where you can get a car. So
I still like the Roadster best.
The Lotus one, the
one that's based on, yeah, the Lotus Elise frame.
The only problem being a person of a certain of being of normal to plus size, as many of our
in and out
on-air
can be
people
difficult.
Are, fitting in the car might be a little, because I'm thinking it's smaller inside than a Miata, and that's a pretty tight fit.
I will say I test drove a Pontiac Solstice, and that was one of the things that I did not like. It had a big center console, and the console was really way up high. So, like, the door, you know, where the window was up high. And so you're sitting low in it, the door's high, which is neither here nor there, but the console's high. So, like, if you go to rest your arm on the center console, it's like almost at your shoulder level. It was like that was
airplane
weird.
Cockpit feel is kind of what that has. Yeah, I sat in one of the Lotuses, and it's you're very very low, like you're extremely low in there. And even this was, you know, a handful of years ago. I haven't gotten any younger, but I remember just my young self getting in and out of that car is kind of tough. There's no graceful way to do
that's
it.
Like,
you can fall into it, but getting back
it's
out.
It's like old Corvettes, right?
Yeah.
Like 70s Corvettes. You know, when you sit down on it, you're basically like 6 inches from the ground, or not that low, but probably 8 to 10 inches from the ground. Like, it's you're sitting almost on the ground.
Yeah, same here. You're sitting very low, and then even the lip of the car, just the doorway of the car, the frame getting in, and then you're sitting down another 6 inches in the seat, at least with this style of seat. It wasn't even like a bucket seat. It was like more of a cockpit kind of seat, and you're in there, you know.
I'm thinking, given that the price is fairly comparable, I'd rather have a insane mode Model S that can cradle my middle-aged ass and still go plenty fast and carry the kids to soccer game or whatever you have to do with it. So, yeah, I'm now at the comfort stage of, I wouldn't
stretch
mind.
Stretch pants.
Donut in the seat.
So, but in other new tech stuff, I don't know that I've ever heard anybody pronounce it. Is it Moleskine, the notebooks, the traveler notebooks that are...
Most people say Moleskine, but...
I always say Moleskine.
Yeah.
Which has nothing to do with moles.
Okay, it does have an E at the end. Yeah, moles, but there is Moleskine, like, to put in your shoes to, like, for blisters and stuff that's separate that they sell. But anyways, the notebook people, so we're not talking about skinning actual moles... they've had smart notebooks before, but they've generally required snapping a photo of the page with your phone or buying some kind of expensive add-on. The new thing is the Moleskine smart writing set. Pairs a real-world notebook with an intelligent app and pen. The notebook called the Paper Tablet has an invisible grid that lets the app know where you are on the page and in the notebook, and has extended rounded edges to recall the curves of an electronic tablet. Pen is powered by Neo technology and uses a hidden camera as a digitizer and transfers the data wirelessly to the Moleskine Notes app and giving you an immediate digital copy of every sketch, note, doodle, and stroke. So that's kind of cool because you can write, you know, you get the tactile feel of writing on paper. I'm sure that this is a version of there's been articles in the past. I haven't seen any lately. But the thing where they came up with a way where the paper has a pattern that you can't really see on it. That's the invisible grid that lets the pen know where you are on the paper.
Yeah, there was a friend of mine who had, like, years ago, like eight years ago, had, I don't remember what the company name was, but had that where you used their notepads, and before you started writing on a page, you would have to, like, touch the upper left corner, like a dot on the corner of the page or something, and then you could start writing. And for based on that, it knew what you were writing. And so at the end, it would record everything for that entire page in the pen.
So it does give you the cool benefits of both, and you can have your stuff on your phone and in person. Sadly, basically, if you've gone in the store and looked at buying the notebooks, the just plain analog, only write on them with a pen you have to buy yourself deal, they're not cheap. And this isn't particularly cheap, but it's not crazy expensive either. It's about $200 for the, I'm guessing once you've got the pen, that then presumably the notebooks are not, shouldn't be so expensive going forward. But
unless you have to get a new pen every time.
The ultimate disposable. The pens are made. The ink is made from baby seal blubber, and we have to kill a new seal every time you buy a new notebook and pen.
So the company says, while they're not killing baby seals, that they really don't care how you pronounce it. So a lot of Moleskine seems to be the American favorite. They say if you absolutely have to, it goes back to a song reference and a stationery store in Paris. The original official pronunciation was Moleskine, if you can believe that. And also they say it's Linux, not Linux.
The worst way I've ever butchered that would not even be close to the actual way you're supposed to say.
Like I said, the company line, they actually have a fact, and they say pronounce it however you want to, but it looks like a lot of people are saying Moleskine. I always thought it was Moleskine. When I actually saw it typed out with an E, I thought, oh, someone made a typo. But no, that is it.
And actually, in the original Paris store, if you Americans asked them how you pronounced it, they said, go to hell, American! And that's what people thought, how you pronounced it.
Maybe it was a store in France, but the people who ran it were Italian, and so it was Moleskine.
and then that's why they added the Eon.
Yeah.
It's kind of look more like what you're saying.
Here's the official line is they're saying that it's a brand name with an undefined national identity intentionally. So they picked something that didn't sound like anything.
It's kind of like Hello Kitty.
Yeah, maybe.
Like,
yeah.
She's not a kitty because she's got a pet cat.
Now what? I just always thought it was kind of a weird relationship.
No, Hello Kitty. Sanrio's come out and said that Hello Kitty is not a cat.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
It's a cat cosplayer.
It's a girl, right?
Dressed as a cat. I don't know. I don't want to think about Hello Kitty too much. We're in brony territory now.
A lot of Japanese things you don't really want to follow all the way to their logical conclusions or something. So that one could be interesting if you want to kind of like sort of ease your migration into the digital world of your phone and keeping your notes on your phone. Of course, one of the things I would suggest if you're going to do that, if you're going to get the Moleskine.
They're based in Milan, so that suddenly makes sense now. Okay.
Make sure that your smartphone is not like the base, 16 gig model, because I have a feeling that you would run out of space a lot quicker if you're taking digitized notes like that. And last week we talked about cold brews of coffee. And then this week Kickstarter is so cool because of all the products that you hear about that'll never get made. No, that I'm kidding. All the products that you hear about really early on, and can get in on the ground floor if you're interested. Brewing your own beer at home can be kind of a chore, and a lot of the machines that do it are like crazy, crazy expensive. There's a new one on Kickstarter called the Art Brew Automated Brewing System. It's an all-in-one machine that lets you use the built-in LCD or the companion app to choose the kind of beer you want to brew. Then you add water, malt, hops, yeast, and anything else the recipe calls for. Whether you get, and the thing with this one that's different, is a lot of them have the, oh, well, it's the Brewmaster 12,000, and it's essentially like the coffee makers where you have to buy the pods from the manufacturer for too much money. This one lets you add the ingredients. They have packages that you can buy from them, but you can just go get your own ingredients. You can go get your own fresh ingredients and use them with this one. So that's kind of cool. You just, you know, make the recipe. Once that's done, you simply hit start and the machine will control the mock sterilization and fermenting, letting you know when your beer is ready to drink and serving it straight from the built-in tap. This sounds like something Homer Simpson would put in his car.
So it actually, does the fermentation process inside of it as well.
Apparently, yes. Huh. And every ingredient has its own container or compartment, so the process is hard to foul up, and your beer is ready in 1 to 3 weeks. So the toughest thing is that apparently if you're wanting to regularly drink the beer, you're going to need like 3 or 4 of these things so that you can have them all going on.
The yield is 8 ounces a day. I just did the math on that. And that's assuming you have to have two machines
going. What if you want to make a lager? Do you have to like
probably they
put it inside of your fridge?
Probably wouldn't do it.
Because it's cold fermentation.
Yeah, I like where this is going, though. If they could just expand this and keep the, you know, the same thing, but maybe apply it to a like a 5-gallon carboy or something
like
that.
So what size does this make?
5.5 liters is the amount of water you start out with, and I would
like
assume
2 gallons?
Yeah, I'd assume you wind up with a little bit less than, you know, 5.5 liters when it's all said and done.
Well, though, if you buy 3 or 4 of them, then you can just kind of have them perpetually producing. How many gallons of beer do you drink a week anyways, Barrett?
I mean, I'm probably...
That's not a good question to ask.
So, I mean... So
if you want an idea of how much beer he drinks in a given week or month or year, go to the Flying Saucer and look for all the 200 club plates that he has hanging. How many you got? 4? 5?
5. Then I stopped. There's actually stuff up there with Linux commands on it. So, yes.
But then you stop.
It ends in -RF.
This
is Barrett before the show. So, I wonder if I should write a Barrett time. Let me think on that.
Nope.
Where have you been all my life today?
I love you, beer.
Sadly, I've never gotten to drink a beer.
He drank his
show.
Way right through season 2 of Mr. Robot.
That's true. You missed when we've gone to the Alabama Ice House prior to the show before and had a little something.
I am
to get
the
ready.
Teetotaler in this scenario, ironically.
Well, it is a little tougher to have a beer and go somewhere when you're riding motorcycles.
Yes, it's very, very difficult. I would never do that.
Yeah, I had a couple of social beers at the Geek Gathering and then Ubered it home. That's the plan.
There you go. Well, so now what?
Look, he's looking at me.
What?
So anyway, we're back to the homebrew cold
yes, homebrew.
Brew. Sorry, I derailed that because
he was already off the rails.
You re-railed it.
Re-railed.
So it yields in about a pint every 2 days, is what it comes out to.
There are bigger, but does it produce it in that kind of? It looked to me like a batch takes some time and that it's like all at once.
Yeah, it is. So 1 to 3 weeks and then you dispense it out.
But that's fermentation process.
Yeah, that's fermentation process.
I mean, the brewing process is going to take, especially like for that, for a couple of gallons,
hour.
It's probably going to take, yeah, like an hour to 2 hours if you did it yourself by hand with you know, old school. So that's not the process that takes very long. The process that takes it a long time is going to be letting
sitting
it sit there
and
ferment, let the yeast eat all the sugars.
You wonder if there's something, if it puts it, if it says it has the tap on it, but I'm assuming maybe you could take out whatever holds the fermenting liquid.
We'd have
and
to
put
like
that somewhere.
You'd have to carbonate it or something.
There's probably a little bit of natural carbonation in there. I don't know. With that price point, it should come with maybe a CO2 cartridge, but I've not read that thoroughly in there yet.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that.
There are larger ones that make larger quantities, but they, of course, the price scales up with that. Or by that point, you pretty much, I would think you'd just get Arduinos and stuff and build one with a, I don't know, software-defined radio that tells you when it's done and stuff.
There's a lot of that going on out there. Not so much, maybe not the SDR angle, but the Raspberry Pis
there's
and
a lot
Arduinos.
There's a lot of people using Arduinos as,
yeah, to control brew temperatures.
My mind just lost the the acronym HRMI systems, whatever. There's a term for it in brewing culture that for basically like automated temperature controls and timing and pumps to like move from one vessel to another automatically and basically to automate the entire process.
And then BrewPi is the one I've looked at for the Raspberry Pi.
BrewPi.
So, yeah, there's a lot out there. You've got a lot of options out there. So, you know, you can definitely, as a home brewer, as a hobbyist, you could cobble together something where you
can.
The
thing is, there's a lot of tech people that are into home brewing.
A lot of crossover.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's been like a renaissance over the last 5 or 6 years where a lot of tech people have gotten into home brewing, is what it seems like. It's not that home brewers get into tech, it's just that there's been like a lot of tech pieces.
A lot of tech people that have gotten into home brewing, yeah.
Well, the tech people, they like the precision of, you know, where to get consistency on your brew and that kind of stuff.
And they like
but then they immediately go, wow, you know, a computer would control this with even more precision than me, and I wouldn't have to stand here and watch it, and then start coming up with automated solutions.
Yeah, that's the main reason I don't brew anymore. I don't have 3 weeks to stand and watch it ferment. You know, you've got to sleep and take naps and eventually go bathe.
But like the stuff of maintaining the temperatures and some of that kind of stuff, it seems like there's, you know, having a cheap device that can watch that and let you know what's going on is easier than if you forget to check it or whatever.
Barrett's brew biography would be titled Robot Strike My Beer.
And final device on Try By Or Fry, Roku, isn't that how we've decided to pronounce that one?
Yes.
Or is it Italian? Roku.
It's Roku. Dwight always said, just in the honor of Dwight, he always said Roku, which is, I think, incorrect.
I always said Rock-you.
Rock-you.
But it's definitely not that.
Roku is how I
Roku,
pronounce it.
Roku.
I declare.
Okay, so Roku continues to regularly update its family of streaming devices, and today they announced a revamped streaming stick. The latest stick will replace the purple dongle the company released in 2014 and works pretty much the same way. Obviously, it has updated internals and some new features.
Is the new stick called the Hurricane? Because if it's called the Hurricane, I'm definitely like going to start calling it Rock-you.
I would think they'd make that their top of the line model if it's going to rock you like a hurricane. Now the new one has dual band MIMO antenna and updated quad core processor, giving it eight times more power than the 2014 one. Even with that improvement, they managed to shave off some bulk from these sticks, so it's closer to thumb drive size. Just like the old streaming stick, this one plugs into your HDMI port on your TV to deliver thousands of, quote, channels or apps that you can watch video through, including, you know, the usuals, Netflix, YouTube, and Time Warner Cable. Unlike the Roku 4 set-top box that the company released late last year, the new stick does not support 4K video. And I like this. It only streams high definition. It only streams 1080p. That's their word in the Ars Technic article, is that it only streams 1080p. The stick comes with a remote, just like the Roku's other devices, but that remote doesn't have a headphone jack for private listening. The thing they did do, though, that with this one that solves that issue, it streams audio via Wi-Fi to your smartphone, so you can plug your headphones into your phone and listen to the show you're watching. So that's kind of... It's an interesting feature to have the streaming to your phone. Even if sticks like the new Chromecast and Amazon Fire TV stick hope to sway customers with price tags under $50, Roku isn't bringing its new stick down to that price point. It will cost $50, same price as the previous version, so they aren't going below. It isn't much more expensive than competitors, but a $15 difference could certainly persuade some customers to choose one over the other if you're shopping by price. Roku believes the new stick's small size and better processor will set it apart from the rest. You know, sometimes when you're in the $50 range, spending a few bucks more might get you more. Just a pro tip there for you. It's on sale today at Roku's website, and it will ship at the end of the month.
Did you say it's... Because I know one of the earlier Roku sticks was one of the first... one of those devices, unlike the Chromecast, that could actually draw power over HDMI because some of the HDMI jacks have power on them. I'm assuming this one can do that as well, or did it say?
It looks like it does. Okay. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it looks like it does. It doesn't say specifically, and it doesn't show a port for plugging it in.
However, it's kind of, it looks a little bit, well, it looks about the same depth or length as the Chromecast. So if you have an HDMI port that doesn't open up to the side, like on a lot of the newer TVs, but one of the old ones that opens up to the back, that could be an issue. Because you probably won't be able to mount it. If it's in front of a wall, it's not going to be that close to the wall.
Yeah.
Now, apparently there is a streaming stick war going on, which I kind of like how the media is calling that. But we've seen like some other Linux sticks and, of course, you know, what Amazon has out there, what Chrome has, or what Google has out there. But it looks like it's kind of heating up a little bit.
Yes, I've just had a vision of the future, which is where you'll have your junk drawer will have streaming video sticks, 128 gig thumb drives, and, you know, various computers that are thumb drive sized that you've had over the years that are now obsolete that you just tossed in a drawer. And now the problem is you don't know which one does what anymore.
I already have some 128 megs in a junk drawer somewhere, some of those sticks. And they're not going to do anything anymore because the cloud's going to be gone.
I have a Cray YMP2 in my junk drawer.
Big drawer. Got some big drawers.
Well, you know, imagine when you've got two or three of these Rokus and a Chromecast and a Fire Stick and some of those all in there, and it just you just toss them in. I bought a kind of cool a wooden tool chest thing that they had at Costco for cheap.
Is it online? Is it like a smart wooden tool chest? Because if it's not, I don't see why you're bothering getting.
No, it's kind of retro. No, the thing about it is
connected things.
It has little wooden drawers on the front that are the right size for the various dongles and electronic parts. So I can, you know, instead of having them in, you know, buckets or you know, where you have to dig through a you know, plastic box full of, you know, various wires that are all the same, that are all white because they're Apple or whatever. Now I've got, this has a bunch of different drawers, and there's one of the little drawers is full of various thumb drive sticks of various capacities. And so at least I can find one when I need one. Because that's the only thing worse than having a junk drawer full of thumb drives is needing one and not being able to find one.
Knowing that you have it, but yeah.
They all disappear once you pop that drawer open when you need one. The only ones that are there are always smaller than the amount of data that you need to get off of whatever you're trying to access.
You know, the last few weeks, I've had the darndest time trying to find a freaking USB to mini USB cable. Like, I used to have a bunch of them. I have no idea. All I can find is micro USB ones. Or I can find that, right, the newer generation, micro USB. Or I can find the old, like, USB B to USB A, like, that you used to plug into printers and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can find those, but I can't find mini ones. Not saying I'm looking for them at stores, like, but in my house. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I used to have a bunch of them. I don't know where any are.
Socks. They go where the socks go.
Looking at the Roku streaming stick, it looks to me like the way that it's supposed to get power is they have one picture. They don't really show it in all the other stuff, but there's one picture that shows how it fits on wall-mounted TVs, and the stick is plugged into the HDMI, and then it has a USB cable that plugs into, it looks like a USB port on the TV.
See,
and
then
you can see the back of it.
You can, that's what the Chromecast does, but I know the original Roku sticks could draw power over HDMI if it was available, but the thing is, not all TVs had it, so it's like I forgot what it is, HDMP or something instead of HDMI. Something. Anyway, it's an HDMI port, but it actually has power on certain port that is designed for, and the Roku took advantage of that.
That looks cool. So the Amazon Fire Stick, I'm not sure if they're opening up the API on that, but Amazon announced earlier today that as far as like the Echo home automation stuff and everything that touches that, they are making free to developers, and you just have to sign up for a developer account, the entire API. So they're calling it Skills. So you can actually go in and program interoperability between other devices. For instance, like maybe your Nest stuff that may not work, or this stuff that may not work through the Nest Hub anymore. you can go, you know, with a little bit of development skill, go write that. Or even better yet, wait, hopefully someone else writes it, publishes it, and then you can go get that. But it's definitely opening that up. And whereas everyone else is kind of closing things off, even Amazon with, you know, you can't play other, you, for instance, I can't play Google Play content on an Amazon device, and I can't, you know, go back and forth with that. You know, the Amazon likes to keep everything, you know, locked down, like, I guess, their Fire tablets versus, you know, like a Nexus 7. So this was kind of a neat move. So it's definitely opening this up and letting people get in there, get their hands dirty, and expand that whole universe. So they just kind of snuck into your living room without notice, without anyone noticing. But it's interesting, and they're still rolling out. I think they're rolling out the Dot, and the Dot started shipping, too, a few days ago. Which is, it's like the Amazon Echo, but it's tiny. There's no external speakers. So it's mainly just it's a bug. It's a listening interface. It sits in your house.
Oh, it's a extender?
It's an extender, more or less, and then it will either stream to Bluetooth speakers, or it's got an audio out where you can actually, you know, like put it next to like a, you know, an external or a bookshelf speaker, or maybe your audio video system or something. But yeah, I was not expecting them to open that up. That's a cool move on their part.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because then once it has, if it has a voice, once they get where they have a voice control, then you could like redo the API stuff by voice instead of, I'm kidding, instead of coding it, coding the API.
Yeah, you need to code an API that lets you code APIs by voice over Alexa. I think that would be extremely infuriating. I heard. C equals C plus, no, Alexa, no.
Well, we have one more segment, and then I'm guessing we can talk it out for the rest of the show.
We might be able to do that.
Seems to we can probably make that. We can just talk about Lee if we have to.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious
science. This one's kind of cool. The you know, it's a concept that's been around for a long time. The deal, you know, if you go up into space, you got to have some place to stay, obviously, you know, like a hotel or something, but you also need it to be able to be something you can get up into space and then deploy. So maybe something you could inflate, you know, like a big bouncy castle for kids, but built to house astronauts and
like a
tourists.
Space hab.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a sci-fi fever dream, but this Friday, SpaceX will launch a so-called expandable, a prototype called the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, BEAM, B-E-A-M, of course, to the International Space Station. It's going to remain there attached to the Tranquility Module for 2 years. Bigelow Aerospace hopes in its time in orbit will prove the technology worthy of inhabitants. Robert Bigelow didn't start his career with visions of space hotels. His thing is he made his fortune with the budget suites.
Oh, I thought you were going to say tea.
Extended stay hotels. No, extended stay hotels with a stove in every room. But he soon expanded his worldview. With his money, he founded the National Institute for Discovery Science to research UFOs and donated $3.7 million to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas to endow a consciousness studies chair. So this guy sounds like he'd be a cool person to sit down and have a beer with. Beyond those interests, he wanted to help people stay in space. So in 1999, he created Bigelow Aerospace to begin work. See, if you're Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, you know decide to rework people's ability to go to space. If you have budget hotels, then you just like try to figure out how to have hotels in space. That's just sort of the compare and contrast. He wasn't the first person to imagine an inflatable outpost in space. He's just the first person who might actually pull it off. You know, obviously you just fill it with air is what's going to keep the space open. Well, happens that air is kind of useful in space.
I like air.
Yeah. Yeah. That design has been around for a long time. I'm pretty sure at least since the 70s,
A lot of satellites. A lot of the big satellites were basically Mylar balloons.
Yeah.
The Echo satellites in 1960 and 1964 were covered in metal and looked like building-sized ball bearings, it says.
I know. When I was working at NASA on Space Station in the...
You were working on the Space Station?
I wasn't on the Space Station. I was working on the Space Station
a balloon
project.
Next?
They wouldn't let me come inside.
But
open the pod bay door, please.
But at some point, I want to say in maybe 98, there was a Spacehab module that was inflatable that they were looking at putting on the space station. And because I was just doing the CAD models, actually CAE modules for the group I was working with. And so that was one of the things. And it was funny because, yeah, like all these other modules basically fit inside of the space shuttle or were on a Soyuz craft size, you know, to fit on their missiles to launch up into space. And so, yeah, when you do this Spacehab module, all of a sudden there's this, like, huge balloonish thing that's, like, much larger than anything else, you know, on the station. It looked odd in the models.
As long as they send an inflatable palm tree just to liven a little nude, I think that would be nice.
Well, their big thing, I know one of the big fears with those, the inflatable modules, is meteorites.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Any kind of, like, small, fast-moving particle that could puncture it, you know. So you have to do, like, multiple layers, and you have to pick what kind of material you're using. There's all kinds of concerns about that because, you know, you start losing air. It has to either heal itself or whatever, because you're going to, at some point, you're probably going to get a puncture, and that's much more susceptible to puncture than, you know, the metal.
You don't want to get knocked out of Earth orbit by doing the deflating balloon method. That's very not graceful.
Well, maybe what they should do is do the inflatable thing, and then you go out and gather all the little rocks and micrometeorites and, like, glue them to the outside, and then they can protect it.
Yes.
It could work. Of course, it'd take a long time. You know, you take a little pebble-sized micrometeorite and put a little dab of glue on it and stick it on the outside. It'd be a long budget. And about the time that you glued the last one on, of course, the material probably would have worn out. They're not using Mylar anymore. They're using Kevlar and Nextel type materials.
Like the phone company?
Yeah, the push-to-talk. So apparently under George H.W. Bush, they had worked on trying these, they call them transhabs, the transit habitat. And then since the International Space Station was already over budget and behind schedule, legislators feared development of a new Aries space station would just add the money to the money and timeline problems. So they canceled it in 2000. And Bigelow read about the cancellation of Transhab, which wasn't a problem for him. It was an opportunity. So he contacted NASA and hired the person. So we'll see what happens this week.
Yeah, I said Spacehab, SpaceX but Falcon 9 will take Transhab. It
up. So this week, this Friday, we'll hear what happens, and hopefully it'll inflate up and we can see what happens.
All right. Well, we didn't have to spend any time dissing Lee on our outro.
Oh, next time.
Next time, while he's here. All right. Well, thank you so much to everyone for tuning in for another episode of Technology Bites. And I don't know when the fundraiser starts, but I know it's coming up soon.
It was in May,
If you'd like to shorten it, go and give now, and then we'll get credit ahead of time.
Yeah, or something. All right. Well, you have been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's Grubos. We'll see you next Wednesday night for more Technology Bites.
KPFT invites you to a celebration of the acclaimed program Democracy Now! And the extraordinary movements and heroes who have moved our country forward. So join us for a visit by Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! On Sunday, May 1st at 1 p.m. Amy Goodman will speak in Houston at the Carl Walker Jr. Multi-Service Center, located at 4300 Noble Street. Visit kpft.org or our Facebook event page for full details. You're encouraged to purchase tickets early because this event is expected to be at capacity. So visit kpft.org for tickets. Proceeds from this visit by Amy Goodman benefit KPFT Houston.
Why donate your car to KPFT? You can free up space in your garage, you can avoid the hassles of selling your car, there's no need to pay hefty car repair bills, and you turn that unwanted car into an IRS tax deduction. In addition, you're helping to make the Houston area better with unique arts, music, and culture. You help keep options on the airwaves. Best of all, making a car donation is easy and always free. Just call 1-855-573-8227 or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Again, that number is 1-855-KPFT-CAR. Thanks for your help. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.